Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we need to continually learn and understand how the Constitution was defined, what each of these lines mean, because in so doing, we can actually start beginning to fathom the magnitude of overreach that the government is dealing with, or that we're dealing with the government. That all comes at a cost, folks. As they assume something new, it costs money. They're going to tax you. This all has rippling effects. So all that being said, the point is that time is now, and we need to actually get engaged, and the whole point is to focus on full compliance of the Constitution. So let me just wrap it up right there. And we're in the Virginia ratification debates, and we just ended with Patrick Henry making an assertion, which kind of had me go down the path of, I'll just say, expounding upon the fact that everything he was saying was all predicated upon the federal government not doing what they were supposed to do. In other words, directly violating the Constitution. So, with all that being said, I think we're ready to pick up where Mr. Lee of Westmoreland actually responds to Patrick Henry. And so, welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you.
And do you have, before we dive into this, I guess I should have asked, anything new happening that you want to give us information on? I mean, we kind of talked before about some local things and so forth. Okay.
Nope, I'm just working on the...
The petition?
The petition right now.
We need to do an aside on that. I don't think we ever connected.
Yes.
Right, okay.
No.
Okay. Yeah, holidays, vacations, they just trample on what we, you know, the important things. Not that those aren't important. Okay, so anyway, go ahead and let's kick it off with, he tells us.
All right. He tells us that he is a staunch Republican and that he adores liberty. I believe him, and when I do so, I wonder that he should say that a kingly government is superior to that system which we admire. He tells you that it cherishes a standing army and that militia alone ought to be dependent upon for the defense of every free country. There is not a gentleman in this house, not even the gentleman himself, there is not man without these walls who admires the militia more than I do. Without vanity, I may say I have had different experience of their service from that of the honorable gentleman. It was my fortune to be a soldier of my country. In the discharge of my duty, I knew the worth of militia. I have seen them perform feats that would do honor to the first veterans in submitting to what would daunt German soldiers. I saw what the honorable gentleman did not see, our men fighting with the troops of that king whom he so much admires. I have seen proofs of the wisdom of that paper on your table. I have seen
incontrovertible
evidence that militia cannot always be relied upon. I could enumerate many instances, but one will suffice. Let the gentleman recollect the action of Guilford. The American regular troops behaved there with the most gallant intrepidity. What did the militia do? The greatest number of them fled. Their abandonment of the regulars occasioned the loss of the field had the line been supported that day. Cornwallis, instead of surrendering at Yorktown, would have laid down his arms at Guilford. This plan provides for the public defense as it ought to do. Regulars are to be employed when necessary, and the service of militia will always be made use of. This, sir, will promote agricultural industry and skill and military discipline and science.
I'm just thinking because I, on Monday and Tuesday, covered the congressional debates the very first year, the very f- first portion of the federal government's functioning where they started talking about Western lands. And so to your benefit, there's nowhere there where they talk about the importance of organizing the territory with a militia as well as a government. And I think that that was a huge problem. That was a huge shortcoming, that they didn't help set expectations for the territory to understand that they have a responsibility to the Union to equally share the responsibility of national defense and so forth. And the fact is that the plan was, and it was wrong, and Madison has only piped in like once or twice. Really, at the beginning of the plan, he has yet to pipe in where the plan is starting to unfold. And I'm curious because, see, Madison was not a military man. And he was really more of the form of governance, you know, what's being enumerated, what's what powers do they have and are charged to, you know, execute. And so as they move forward, I think this is a huge gaffe. And so, and I'm just saying this because I'm seeing the ratification debates, and they're talking about how important the militia is here. And it is. It absolutely is, because the militia is the entity that is supposed to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. Huge. So, anyway, let's keep going.
Okay. I cannot understand the implication of the honorable gentleman that because Congress may arm the militia, the states cannot do it. Nor do I understand the reverse of the proposition. The states are, by no part of the plan before you, precluded from arming and disciplining the militia should Congress neglect it.
Okay, at that point right there, if Congress neglects it, then the states should be able to place, and we've mentioned this before, a requisition to the federal government to say, you owe us this much money. Because it is their financial responsibility to equip, train, and discipline. In other words, train, create standards and that type of thing. So if they neglect that, then the states need to do that. And if the states fail, if the states actually do that, then they should actually be able to go to the federal government, who's failed to do it, and say, this is what it costs. This is what we spent on this armament and equipment and so forth. And, oh, by the way, you know, we're basing this all off of, you know, what you were set, because hopefully they've set these standards. Now, if they haven't set the standards, if the federal government even neglects those basic details of the discipline and those things that would require uniformity throughout all states, i.e. how they wear their uniforms and how, you know, they arm, you know, what they arm themselves with, the type of ammo and so forth. So if they do this, they should be able to either set a requisition to the federal government or relieve themselves of the apportionment to say, you're taxing us for this much and we're basically going to recoup this basic because you owe us this much money. In other words, negate what they're doing or what they're not doing and what they had to pay to do. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, I know I've probably talked about that before, but as I see things actually unfolding in the very first year, there was very little talk, and they had a War Department discussion, but it was so short, I don't think they even talked about, you know, when are you going to get the militia going? More importantly, the first focus should have been, when are you going to get the Navy? But I'll have to dive into that separately. But anyway, I digress. Go ahead. Keep going.
Okay. In the course of Saturday and some previous harangues from the terms in which some of the northern states were spoken of, one would have thought that the love of an American was in some degree criminal, as being incompatible with a proper degree of affection for a Virginian. The people of America, sir, are one people. I love the people of the North, not because they have adopted the Constitution, but because I fought with them as my as my countrymen and because I consider them as such? Does it follow from hence that I have forgotten my attachment to my native state? In all local matters I shall be a Virginian, and those of the general nature I shall not forget that I am an American.
Yeah, okay. So here's an interesting thing, too, because they talk and they reference Montesquieu a lot. And so as we kind of look at Montesquieu's paradigm regarding the effectiveness of a republic in a small application, that the larger, the more difficult, the more arduous, and the more problematic a republic is. And so I don't think these men realized that you can have three overarching republics, that there would be the national republic, where there's the union and the basis of the union, i.e. national defense, you know, sovereignty, those very few things that was necessary to create the Constitution and create the federal government to serve the states as a general government. And then going into the states, most of these men should have understood, because we'll find it in the Virginia ratification debates, where Mr. Grayson kind of comes up, and he's an anti-federalist, but at least he gets it, that the relationship to the states, to the federal government, is the same as the county to the state legislature. There is a direct relationship that the parties to the compact are those that have a responsibility in keeping government in check. Ultimately, it rests on our shoulders. Ultimately, we all have to make sure that our public servants are doing what they're supposed to be doing. And because we have failed, look how far they have gotten outside the bounds of the Constitution. So we got a lot of work to do. All we need to do is demand compliance. That's all, that's our job. Demand compliance, and do not permit or do not allow compromise. Do not allow, you know, half-stepping. As far as I'm concerned, if you've got a public servant at the county level and they're not willing to fully support the Constitution and get things pushing and moving, the elixir is far less poisonous than the direction we're being pushed into the global arms of communism, or I should say this global government that we're being pushed into. I would much rather have, you know, lean days where we may struggle with the environment or so forth, but that is to our own accord. At least we will have control. It's not like we'll be fighting government who will be managing, shutting us down, locking us down, basically doing things to us like they do in those 15-minute cities in China, where they fully control and manipulate us to basically surrender everything. That's what's on the line here. And so we have to begin demanding, and that our county legislators absolutely understand this. They need to get this in their head. So as we dive a little bit further down, Mr. Lee starts talking about enumerations. Go ahead.
I say that this new system shows in stronger terms than words could declare that the liberties of the people are secure. It goes on the principle that all power is in the people and that rulers have no powers but what are enumerated in that paper. When a question arises with respect to the legality of any power exercised or assumed by Congress, it is plain on the side of the governed. It is enumerated in the Constitution? If it be, it is legal and just. It is otherwise arbitrary and unconstitutional. Candor must confess that it is infinitely more attentive to the liberties of the people than any state government. Mr. Right. Lee.
Yeah, go ahead. Keep going.
Mr. Lee then said that under the state governments, the people reserved to themselves certain enumerated rights, and that the rest were vested in their rulers, that consequently the powers reserved to the people were but an inconsiderable exception from what were given to their rulers, but that in the federal government the rulers of the people were vested with certain defined powers and that what were not delegated to those rulers were retained by the people.
Okay,
the consequence of this, he said, that...
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
So right there, he really clarifies the contrast between the fact that the general powers are granted in England, where in America, under this new constitution, there are certain defined powers, and that what were not delegated to those rulers are retained by the people. So they keep on, this is the consistency. They keep on saying the exact same thing. So there's no incongruity. There is no disharmony. There is no conflict when the federal say, oh, yeah, well, you know, the federal government could do whatever they want to do. They never said that. They never changed the position on what the federal government is supposed to do. So what happened? Why is it that the people, the states, and those who went into government didn't stay within those bounds? That's the biggest question. That's a million-dollar question, but go ahead.
Mm-hmm. The consequence of this, he said, was that the limited powers were only an exception to those which rested in the people, and that they knew what they had given up and could be in no danger. He exemplified the proposition in a familiar manner. He observed that if a man delegated certain powers to an agent, it would be an insult upon common sense to suppose that the agent could legally transact any business for his principal which was not contained in the commission whereby the powers were delegated, but that if a man empowered his representative or agent to transact all his business except certain enumerated parts, the clear result was that the agent could lawfully transact every possible part of his principal's business except the enumerated parts, and added that these plain propositions were sufficient to demonstrate the inutility and folly where he permitted to use the expression of bills of rights.
Okay. So as we kind of lay this down, and the Bill of Rights had yet to actually become fruitful, because the whole point was, why do we need a Bill of Rights? And the reality is that the Bill of Rights is only a list of things that they can't do. What they provided to the government, what they had done, is they delegated the only things they can do. So why come up with a list of things you don't want them to do?
Okay. Yeah.
All right. So now Mr. Randolph, or Governor Randolph, actually kind of steps up and he speaks about exclusive legislation. And this is basically dealing with the, and you know what, I don't have it highlighted, but
yes.
I believe it's right in here where this one paragraph. So go ahead, and I'm going to go ahead and highlight it as yellow,
okay.
But go ahead.
Okay. I beg the honorable gentleman to pardon me for reminding him that his historical references and quotations are not accurate. If he errs so much with respect to his facts as he has done in history, we cannot depend on his information or assertions. He had early in the debates instanced Holland as a happy democracy, highly worthy of our imitation. From thence, he went over the mountains to Switzerland to find another democracy. He represented all those cantons as being of the democratic kind. I wish he had reflected a little more and distinguished those that are democratical from those which are aristocratical. He has already been reminded of his errors. I should not now put him right with respect to history had he not continued his mistakes. Consult all writers, from Sir William Temple to those of modern times. They will inform you that the Republic of Holland is an aristocracy. He has inveighed against the stadtholder. I do not understand this application of this to the American president. It is well known that but for the stadtholder, the Republic would have been ruined long ago. Holland, it seems, has no 10 miles square, but she has The Hague, where the deputies of the states assemble.
Mm-hmm.
It has been found necessary to have a fixed place of meeting, but the influence which it has given the province of Holland to have the seat of government within its territory, subject in some respects to its control, has been injurious to other provinces. provinces. The wisdom of the convention is therefore manifest in granting the Congress exclusive jurisdiction over the place of their session. I'm going to correct a still greater error which he has committed, not in order to show any little knowledge of the history I have, for I am by no means satisfied with its extent, but to endeavor to prevent any impressions from being made by improper and mistaken representations.
Now, as I kind of scrub through here, exclusive legislation isn't really being brought up other than the fact that they're talking about the types of governments that they're using as an example in Britain, or not in Britain, in Europe. And so the Hague is, I believe, still that place. As a matter of fact, the Jural assemblies are basically point to the Hague as their point of contact as they try to create a new government. And I've kind of covered this in another show with an interview, but that right there is an insurrection against the Constitution when people try to organize. And, you know, it's funny because the way the Jural assembly works, you may have 20 people in a given state or in a given county that has probably 100,000, 50,000, whatever. And 20 people basically say, hey, we don't buy into what this is. We're going to declare this county as a constitutional county. And like they're the kings. Like they have this, you know, this some power that they have the ability to call upon. And then they go to the Hague, you know, to basically say, we are now, you know, a recognized, you know, constitutional county in a constitutional state. And we are no longer a part of the United States. Well, hold on here. How are just you few people, you know, just, I mean, minuscule. You're not even representative of the people of the county. How did you make that county constitutional? And as a matter of fact, if the people, or I should say, not constitutional, they've actually created a new government outside of the Constitution. So how is it that the people in that county, I mean, if they found out that there were these people doing this, I think that they would be pretty upset. I would be.
Mm-hmm.
Who do you think you are? We never elected you to do this. You took this upon yourself. So anyway, he kind of goes through a lot of different points here, and I just don't want to belabor it, but he talks about the Bill of Rights and all of these, you know, the Magna Carta, and so forth and so on. And so as we kind of move forward, let's just jump down to where Governor Randolph then speaks again. And he starts talking about interposition, the president not to have a council. So let's go ahead into that one.
All right. He observed that the only question was with respect to previous and subsequent amendments. Were this the only question, sir, I am sure this inconsiderable matter would not long retard a decision. I conceive the preservation of the Union to be a question of great magnitude. This must be a peculiar object of my attention unless I depart from that rule which has regulated my conduct since the introduction of federal measures. Suppose, contrary to my expectation, this convention should propose certain amendments previous to its ratification, mild and pliant as those states may be who have received it unanimously, flexible as those may be who have adopted it by a majority, I had rather argue from human nature that they will not recede from their resolutions to accommodate our caprice. Is there no jealousy existing between the states? They discover no superiority in any one state of arrogating to itself a fight to dictate what ought to be done. They would not see the reasons of such amendments, for some amendments in themselves are really dangerous.
Okay.
The same reasons could not be impressed.
Okay, so now we're going into a break. So, my bad. What we'll do is we'll pick this back up when we come back. But obviously, Governor Randolph is trying to point out that the president does have the ability to have a council and so forth. And we'll dive into this because I'm going to run out of time. So we'll dive into this when we come right back. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so, bringing this back, he basically is kind of going through this concept that under the federal constitution, the president is going to have an executive council, which is when you go through the Article 2, you can see that he will have, and what they ended up doing was they created a secretary of the foreign affairs, secretary of the treasury, I don't think he was a secretary. They created a general accounting offices that the president in basically administering the foreign policy and administering, you know, treaties and trade and those types of things, he needed to have the ability to, you know, delegate those powers to somebody else because the president was going to be too busy. In addition to that, he also had emissaries, or what we would call ambassadors, that would be deployed out to other nations. And in addition, there would be other nations that would be deploying their emissaries to us here. And instead of the president dealing directly with that, the Secretary of State or the Secretary of Foreign Affairs at the time would be the one that would do all of that coordinating so that the president wouldn't be bogged down with the minutiae. And that's what having a council. So go ahead, pick it up where you were. Thank you. Oh, and as a matter of fact, I muted you, so you're now unmuted.
All right. I wasn't able to hear anything.
Well, I remember you were just talking about the accommodate our caprice. So go ahead and pick it up with, is there no jealousy existing between the states?
Okay.
Is there no jealousy existing between the states? They discover no superiority in any one state of arrogating to itself a fight to dictate what ought to be done. Moving on, they would not see the reason of such amendments, for some amendments in themselves are really dangerous. The same reasons could not be impressed. You see that now? You know where we're
on? I do, yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
The same reasons could not be impressed on all the states. I shall mention one example. I shall suppose, for instance, that we shall propose as an amendment that the president shall have a council. I conceive a council to be injurious to the executive. The counselors will either impede or clog the president, or if he be a man of dexterity, they will be governed by him. They will also impair his responsibility. It is probable that all other states would think alike on the subject or agree to such an alteration, as there is a mode in the Constitution itself to procure amendments not by reference to the people but by the interposition of the state legislatures. Will the people of Virginia bind themselves not to enter into the Union till amendments shall have been obtained? I refer it to any gentleman here whether this may not entirely exclude us from the Union.
Okay, so when he's talking about interposing for amendments, is there any case when that happened? Yeah, actually, there's one case. The 11th Amendment where the state said, you know what, we're not having this. You're not pulling our, you know, our courts in defending ourselves against people from other states or from foreigners. Well, you're not pulling us in and basically trying to be the good political, you know, the politically correct court or what have you, so that you can have some skin in the game in basically controlling us. Because when you think about it, when foreigners try to sue a state and they try to take advantage, if the federal government actually is, I'll say, weaponized, where they're actually, they've been corrupted for the globalist agenda, then they'll actually start ruling in favor and start doing things in favor of foreign ownership and foreign control. Now, they don't have the authority to do that, nor did the states want them to have the authority regarding the courts to do that, which is why they had the 11th Amendment passed, or they proposed it, and it was passed. And it was passed in 1798. So so now we actually dive into some details. Now, the reason this it says 24 is these are additional points regarding the militia that came, that jumped out, that I didn't include before. So this is something that we just identified last year as imperative to read. And so now Governor Randolph dives into the militia regarding, you know, the Union and Congress and so forth.
Sorry, I had to make sure I'm not on mute. Another construction he gives is that it is exclusively in the power of Congress to arm the militia, and that the states could not do it if Congress thought proper to neglect it. I am astonished how this idea could enter into the gentleman's mind, whose acuteness no man doubts. How can this be fairly deduced from the following clause? To provide for the organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for government and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. He complains much of implication, but in this case he has made use of it himself, for his construction of this clause cannot possibly be supported without it. It is clear and self-evident that the pretended danger cannot result from the clause. Should Congress neglect to arm or discipline the militia, the states are fully possessed of the power of doing it, for they are restrained from it by no part of the Constitution.
In other words, there's nothing in there that says the states cannot do that. It basically says that the federal government will provide or has the power to provide for the training, arming, and so forth. So, more importantly, if the states actually have to do it, like I said, and they didn't get into the money bit, but they should have, because whatever that cost is, that is something that would become the onus of the federal government to pay. That is their job. So if they choose not to write a check, if they choose not to get involved, then the states can kind of do that. Now, if the federal government really goes down this path of going and creating this, its own perversion of the militia and the federal, you know, the federal army and so forth, which is what they ended up doing, then the states could have easily interposed and actually created an amendment to allow the states themselves to coordinate and actually, you know, take it away from Congress, take it away from, you know, the federal government regarding how the militia is going to get trained, those standards, let the states. And this is where I think the brilliance would have come. Had the states actually stepped in and said, we're going to have full control over this. We're going to have the best military possibly, because we don't want you to be able to either neglect or set us up to fail. Because even though they would never say those words, they wouldn't want to taste those words in basically charging these people with treason. But the reality is, down the road, it can happen. And so wouldn't it be better? Wouldn't the strategic interest of the Union be better in the hands of the states over this particular issue of how the states would be, you know, well-equipped and well-armed to be able to actually do what was necessary in their state to execute laws in their state to basically do these things that they wouldn't necessarily need the federal militia if they actually all had a proper militia configured and operating. And I would even go as far as to say, at that point, as the states are operating this militia, why would they not integrate the militia into executing the laws of the states, the laws of the county, and suppressing insurrections, riotous behavior? In other words, we're going to go through this, and down the road, Madison's going to say, you know, that the Constitution will not permit people to be out there protesting and riotous behavior. That is uncivil and unacceptable. We are giving, and what ended up happening was they granted them the protection over the First Amendment right of petition. It didn't mean that the federal government could not keep them from petitioning. It just didn't have a Bill of Rights restraining them from being able to abridge those rights, because that was the want of the Bill of Rights. Is there any language in the Constitution that allows them to abridge the people applying their rights of petition, their rights of religious expression? And so, no, not at all. So they can't do any of it. But the point is that the Bill of Rights extended and made sure that the people did at least now know. Because I look at why is the language of the First Amendment and the right of petition and abridging it, why is that important today? Because nobody even understands what it means, because we've been dumbed down and been deliberately indoctrinated not to know what a petition is in holding government accountable. See, if your government, a couple of hundred years ago, if you were government, you know, and let's just say you were just this one thinking blob of all these people, everybody was kind of coming to the consensus, I don't want to be held accountable. So what do we do to keep from being held accountable? We have to basically, without erasing that line in the Constitution, basically alter the conception that, oh, your redress, your right is a right of protest, that you should just be out in the street yelling and screaming and not bothering us so that we can do our job. And that's exactly what happened. And the judges basically supported this subversive concept of the right of protest, which flies in the face of exactly what Madison said, and we're going to get to it. But when we do, I'm going to go, ha, 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 see, here it is, that riotous behavior is absolutely uncivil behavior, is not acceptable. We are a civilized society. This is a civil government, and you have civil rights. And therefore, we expect you to behave properly. Going out there and protesting, unacceptable. So how did that happen? Because that's what government needed and wanted, so that they could get us out of their hair and be able to get away with doing more and more against us. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. So let's keep going. So restrain from it. So the general defense of welfare.
Yeah. Hold on. I didn't know if we were in the middle of it.
No. Okay. We ended it.
So, yeah. The sweeping clause, as it is called, is much dreaded. I find that I differ from several gentlemen on this point. This formidable clause does not in the least increase the powers of Congress. It is only inserted for greater cautions and to prevent the possibility of encroaching upon the powers of Congress. No sophistry will be permitted to be used to explain away any of those powers, nor can they possibly assume any other power but what is contained in the Constitution without absolute usurpation. Another security is that if they attempt such a usurpation, the influence of the state governments will nip it in the bud of hope. I know this government will be cautiously watched. The smallest assumption of power will be sounded in alarm to the people, and followed by bold and active opposition. I hope that my countrymen will keep guard against every arrogation of power. I shall take notice of what the honorable gentleman said with respect to the power to provide for the general welfare. The meaning of this clause has been perverted to alarm our apprehensions. The whole clause has not been read together. It enables Congress to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States, but all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. The plain and obvious meaning of this is that no more duties, taxes, imposts, and excises shall be laid than are sufficient to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States.
Okay, so technically, what is mentioned later on, because I don't think Governor Randolph kind of, you know, articulated it right well here or correctly, was the fact that this general welfare and defense clause is not granting general powers. What this is a preamble. In other words, that whole part that he read, to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the general defense and provide for the common defense and the general welfare of the United States, but all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States, close quote. That right there is a preamble that helps explain why the following powers are what is being granted. The preamble is not granting power. It's explaining what is going to be following, that they're going to have these powers to do this basic thing of laying taxes and being able to pay the debt and do those things that they're responsible for, waging war, fighting war, what have you. So that makes sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. So anyway, now what we want to do is go down into the next section here, where this is Mr. Monroe, and actually, by the way, the point to keep in mind is he is an anti-federalist. Okay? So let's look at what he's saying here.
Okay, what is the object of the division of power in America? Why is the government divided into different branches? For a more faithful and regular administration, where is there a check? We have more to apprehend from the union of these branches than from the subversion of any, and this union will destroy the rights of the people. There is nothing to prevent this coalition but the contest which will probably subsist between the general government and the individual governments will tend to produce it. There is a division of sovereignty between the national and state governments. How far, then, will they coalesce together? Is it not to be supposed that there will be a conflict between them? If so, will not the members of the former combine together? Where then will be the check to prevent encroachments on the rights of the people? There is not a third essentially distinct branch to preserve a just equilibrium or to prevent such encroachments. In developing this plan of government, we ought to attend to the necessity of having checks. Mm-hmm. I can see no real checks in it.
Okay.
Let us first inquire into the probability of harmony between the general and individual governments, and then in the next place, into the responsibility of the general government, either to the people at large or to the state legislatures. As to the harmony between the governments, communion of powers, legislative and judicial, forbids it.
Okay, so he's kind of making some assertions here. That thinks that there is going to be this sucking up, that the states and the union will basically surrender themselves to the federal government. Actually, they can't do that. As a matter of fact, if the federal government does what they're supposed to do, and only those things that they have the power to do, then the states will not be able to be lured by, you know, I'll just say, you know, corruption by using money to buy them and so forth. The problem isn't whether they're going to, whether the federal government or people acting in the federal government, like Hamilton, are going to go beyond their powers, make implied or implications that they have other powers, you know, hidden or implied within these things that they're talking about, whether it's the taxes, what have you. And so what will happen is if the federal government does try to go down the path of doing something it doesn't have the authority to do, then the states are responsible, just as Governor Randolph just said. It is the states' excuse me, it's the state's responsibility to step up and say, hey, hold on here. You can't do that. You're assuming a power that you don't have, which is critical in understanding, which is why you've heard me say this before, where the Bill of Rights became the problem. Because as long as everybody was watching the Bill of Rights, they weren't keeping track of what was enumerated and what the federal government could do and what it couldn't do. So when it started doing things that it didn't have the power to do, then everybody goes, well, hey, as long as I can still go to church and as long as I still got my guns and as long as, you know, we're doing these other things, then I'm okay with that. They don't even know. You got to remember that D.C. is its own little world. How many states, other than their senators and the congressmen that are representing the people in the states that are sitting in there, you know, if they choose to go tight-lipped and start doing things and not tell everybody what they're doing, then who's to blame? The states and the people. Because it is our job to, you know, basically oversee and make sure we keep a check and oppose every infraction. But what happened was the states, oh, well, can you guys do that? Well, here's the money. Do you want the money to do it? And they said, well, yeah, I think so. I think I do want to do this. So that's how they colluded in their corruption by printing money and delivering it to the states and saying, here you go, let's go do this. Now, the next note or the next comment is by John Marshall, who becomes the Supreme Court justice single-handedly for for putting in play judicial review, as well as the Federalist Papers that down the road would truly turn the Constitution upside down. Go ahead. Now, what he's saying here, by the way, folks, when we read these things, keep in context to what he's saying and how he's saying it. He's going to be talking about what the federal government can do and that, you know, if anything otherwise would be a violation. Down the road, when he says, well, we can do these things, based on what he says here, he changed his tune as a justice saying, well, now you're advocating for the federal government to violate the Constitution or assuming implied powers. So that's why we really need to scrutinize what this man is saying, because down the road, he actually backspeaks everything he said here in the ratification debates. He backpedals everything and says, oh, well, you know, the federal government is, you know, supreme in all things. And if it deems it's necessary and proper, then they can do these things. So go ahead now.
Mr. Chairman, I can see that the object of the discussion now before us is whether democracy or despotism be most eligible. I am sure that those who framed the system submitted to our investigations and those who now support it intend the establishment and security of the former. The supporters of the Constitution claim the fight of being firm friends of the liberty and the rights of mankind. They say that they consider it as the best means of protecting liberty. We, sir, idolize democracy. Those who oppose it have bestowed eulogiums in monarchy. We prefer this system to any monarchy because we are convinced that it has a greater tendency to secure our liberty and promote our happiness. We admire it because we think it a well-regulated democracy. It is recommended to the good people of this country. They are through us to declare whether it be such a plan of government as will establish and secure their freedom.
Okay, keep going.
Permit me to attend to what the Honorable Gentleman, Mr. Henry, has said. He has expatiated on the necessity of a due attention to certain maxims, to certain fundamental principles from which a free people ought never to depart. I concur with him in the propriety of the observance of such maxims. They are necessary in any government, but more essential to democracy than to any other. What are the favorite maxims of democracy? A strict observance of justice and public faith and a steady adherence to virtue. These, sir, are the principles of a good government. No mischief, no misfortune ought to deter us from a strict observance of justice and public faith. Would to heaven that these principles have been observed under the present government. Had this been the case, the Friends of Liberty would not be so willing now to part with it. Can we boast that our government is founded on these maxims? Can we pretend to the enjoyment of political freedom or security when we are told that a man has been, by an act of assembly, struck out of existence without a trial by jury, without examination, without being confronted with his accusers and witnesses, without the benefits of the law and of the land? Where is our safety? When we are told that this act was justifiable because the person was not a
Socrates.
Socrates, What has become of the worthy members' maxims? Is this one of them? Shall it be a maxim that a man shall be deprived of his life without the benefit of law? So shall such a deprivation of life be justified by answering that a man's life was not taken secundum artem because he was a bad man? Shall it be a maximum that government ought not to be empowered to protect virtue?
And so he's kind of talking about the common law. This, remember, we already kind of covered this in other debates, and they kind of started talking about this already in this debate because they talked about the differences of the forms of government, the difference of how they applied the common law in each state. To be clear, the Constitution did not force and did not, create a common law system. It created a limited and defined government of those things that are very limited, that they can actually create laws where those things enumerate. In other words, they can only create a law that's a derivative or directly tied to an enumerated power, such as a uniform law of bankruptcy, a uniform law of naturalization. Those are the only laws that they can create. They just can't say, we're going to create a healthcare plan. We're going to create labor laws. We're going to create housing standards. We're going to create regulations and laws on the environment. For them to do those things requires an amendment. And therefore, when they go down the path of actually creating laws that they don't have the power to do, then again, it is the responsibility of the people in the states to say, you don't have that power, which is exactly why Thomas Jefferson and James Madison stood up against the Alien and Sedition Acts. They said that power is what you've assumed in those laws are powers not delegated. They're direct violations of the Constitution. And so what he's kind of talking about is he's talking about this importance of the people benefiting. We're really out of time now. And so we'll have you back tomorrow. Thank you very much, Tammy. So just let me close on this one concept, folks, that when they're looking at justice, justice for the people, justice for the people is based upon our legal system. The legal system has been employed to ensure the enforcement and the living by the law. I'll reassert this tomorrow, just for everybody's benefit. But as we always say, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.